But was there a difference between playing in Chicago and Minneapolis?
Yes, there was.
What was the difference?
The scene that Minneapolis didn't have yet, but Minneapolis did turn into that scene. It was a place to go that you could have long hair, and a place to be part of, you know, with the new acts that were coming in. And everyone was trying to go to their own style. I remember one show that we played. It was right near when Martin Luther King died, and that was a scary day the next day for us. But bands like CTA, Chicago, I mean, we were headlining and they were just getting going. And so, and I remember this one club, it was on State Street. It wasn't in Old Town, but it was on State Street. They had kind of concert bars there on State Street at the time. And I remember being in the balcony. It was a club where they had a balcony. And I'm watching Chicago and I'm going, oh my God, you know, what's this? Yeah, this is great. And it was just so much fun to be a part of. Everyone was starting to try to go for it. But the scene was the audience, the people that were a part of it, they were the most important part of it, the people that really liked us, of who we are. And we didn't copy anybody. You know, even if we were doing a cover song, it was our way, the way we wanted. And it was accepted, you know, by the crowds.
You also started using flash pots and a fog generator.
Mm-hmm.
And Dan Rinaldi started smashing his guitar on stage, too. Did he start that in Chicago, or was he doing that in Minneapolis, too?
We were all doing it. I went through a lot of drum sets myself.
I assume you were inspired by The Who.
It was what The Who experienced, how they trashed their gear, is we had the same in us. And it wasn't a copy of them. It was, there's nothing like, I mean, people would go, well, why are you trying to wreck stuff, you know? And it how can I explain this? It was, there's something about it that, like, kicking over my drums and throwing it, I felt free that I could do whatever I wanted to. They were mine. And Dan loved wrecking guitars. You know, we just like trashing the stuff, you know.
So you actually saw The Who when they came to Minneapolis on August 20th, 1967 at the Minneapolis Convention Center, right?
Yeah, I remember one Who show. They were third billing. And Hermits was, and what was the name of the band? The Blues Magoos. That was a show that I first saw them. And then, what, a couple of years later, you know, we did dates with them. That was the Emerge days.
Right. You also played a lot of gigs at the New City Opera House in Minneapolis. What do you recall about that club?
That was our club. That was probably the one that we were most known for, to play that room. And that was the place to play, you know. That was before the Depot, you know, First Avenue. And that was the place to play. If you were anybody, you played that room. And we used to fill it.
Do you remember the Palace in Chicago? You played a job there with the Little Boy Blues.
Oh, Little Boy Blues. Yeah, I remember that. That band should have made it. I never know what happened to them. But they had one of the greatest frontmans I ever seen.
Was that a Chicago band?
Yeah.
So did you run into any of the other Chicago bands, like the Shadows of Night, the Buckinghams, the Crying Shames, those guys?
We were buds with all of them. It was kind of like what Minneapolis finally got to be, that the bands were in competition, but we were all family. We were going for the same thing, is the success of our bands, where And there was the same feeling in Chicago at the time. I mean, we were really friends with the Shadows of Night. The guitar player of the Buckinghams wanted to be the guitar player of the Litter. You know, and I think that was right around when Zippy quit.
Okay.
I think the guitar player of Buckinghams went, you know, because he was more of a rocker. The Buckinghams were kind of
pop.
Yeah, yeah.
Looking at my notes, I see on March 10, 1968, the Litter opened up for The Who at the Civic Opera House in Aurora, Illinois. Is that the one where you helped out Keith Moon with his broken snare drum?
No, I thought that was in Chicago.
That was it. Well, this is out right outside of Chicago. This
yeah,
is
it was
a suburb.
I remember the venue. It was like a tiered, like five stories high.
That'd be the opera. That's this one. That's the opera house.
Yeah, that was the one that had happened.
So what happened at the Opera House when you were playing, opening up for The Who?
I broke. I always had two snare drums. The first song we started, I broke the snare drum. My tech, he always sat behind me on all the shows that I played, and so he grabbed me the other snare, and we started to do the second song, and I broke that one too. So we were sitting there. He was trying to get the head off the first one, and then all of a sudden I hear from the side stage, "Hey!" And I see Keith Moon, and he has his snare drum, and he says, "Here!" And he throws it all the way across the stage, and my tech, you know, caught it, and I thought that was the coolest thing, and from that day, because you know, a lot of, there's some musicians that are really picky with their stuff, and you know, they don't want anyone to, you know, play it, especially guitar players, you know, and when that happened, I always told my techs, again through my whole career after that, I said, if we're playing with any other drummers, if something happens, you make sure that they're taken care of, you know, and that felt good. But when Keith did that to me, it was like, you got class, man. You know.
Do you recall?
And he was nuts. He was totally nuts.
Do you recall playing at the Peppermint Lounge in New York?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Yeah, I think we got in trouble with, they had go-go dancers, but they were prostitutes. And it wasn't me. You know, I was cute and sweet. Yeah. But, I think Dan and Jim Kane were with them, but they didn't pay. You know, it was just, you know, we were there and they were girls and, you know, you were with them. And
well, okay. What do you recall about the Cheetah Clubs? I think there was one in Chicago, New York, and L.A.
Mm-hmm.
Did you play all three?
All three.
Let's see. I'm reading through some of the names you played with. The Who, Brian Auger and the Trinity, Canned Heat, Iron Butterfly, Genesis, Eric Burden and War, Blue Cheer, The Stooges, The Amboy Dukes, Joe Cocker, Grand Funk Railroad, Led Zeppelin, Cream, Three Dog Night, Mountain, Jethro Tull, Savoy Brown, Creedence Clearwater Revival, and others. Did you have a contest with Blue Cheer to see who could play the loudest?
Mm-hmm.
Where was that?
We were, that was in Chicago at, I think it was at the Kinetic Playground, and they were advertising because they had marshals, and through Canned Heat, we were friends with them, and they had a guy out in L.A. that were custom making amps called TNT, and so we bought all of them. You know, Sean had I think 8 cabinets. Dan had these two huge cabinets that were like 4 of them, and designed. And I remember that normally a Marshall will be 100 watt was a good size Marshall. And these were actually 950 watts ahead. And so Blue Cheer didn't have a chance with us. We turned it up to 11, basically. And people were coming out of that show and they couldn't hear for a week. And we won.
was it judged by the audience members, or who judged it?
I don't remember who judged it, but I remember it was loud. And I had my
Deaf Society.
Yeah, and I had my own PA on the drums, so we had all the TNT amps, and but I had speaker cabinets next to my drums, you know, that would have the drums go off the stage in like mains, you know, on stage, and still people still once in a while comment that we're at that show, and you know. It's. I don't think any other bands were ever louder than we were. You know, well, we did the Upbeat show, out of Cleveland. Yeah, we did. We did a number of television spots. The one we did in Chicago and the Upbeat show, and that was a national show. And Booker T and the MGs were the house band on it. And the day of the airing, something happened the news wise, and they went to special bulletin, and it never aired.
Okay, so on August 18, 1968, the Litter were hired to perform 7 songs at the Electric Theater for a Paramount Pictures movie called Medium Cool. And the band was paid $500 for one day of work. What do you recall about recording for this movie?
We did the recording. I kind of loved it because I got a really good shot on it where I, you know, had about 20, 30 seconds, you know. And where my hair was, it was like, I looked like Cuz of It. It was all down because he didn't cut my bangs, so it was like that. And that was really fun. But our tracks weren't, for some reason, they didn't sound right or something happened. When we finally saw the movie, they used a Frank Zappa song, you know, music underneath of it. So it was us there, and Zippy was there. They never showed a shot of Dan Rinaldi on the movie, and that's when we. I'm gonna have some fun with this. Yeah, I love Zippy. You know, we were still there, but we went down to Mexico, and he bought a sombrero. And he wore that sombrero on the movie, and that was, and I still give him shit now once in a while because if we get together, I said, "Okay, are you gonna wear a sombrero?"
A big Mexican sombrero. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wear that on for the movie.
Yeah.
¿Qué pasa?
And he regrets it now. We're wearing it, you know.
So looking at the timeline, it looks like right after that movie was shot in August 1968. You had a little switch up here in the lineup, and Denny Waite and Zippy Kaplan exited the band. What happened at that time?
For a while, it was Lonnie Knight, and he came out of Joker's Wild. He was in Joker's Wild at the time. Greg Springer, he played keyboards and vocals. Dan Rinaldi, of course, rhythm guitar. Jim was still on bass, and I was still on drums.
Okay, so I understand that Lonnie Knight and Greg Springer lasted roughly about 6 weeks with the Litter, is that correct?
About that. It was a real short time.
And then they returned to Minneapolis. And who took over after they left the band?
Well, Mark Gallagher came in, and we really liked him. So he joined the Litter.
Where did you find him?
He came from Joliet.
Illinois.
And he came into town, and we tried him out, and he had the signature voice that we were looking, because Denny had the signature voice for the first two albums.
Right.
And Mark had the signature voice we wanted. Plus, he was a signature singer, like nobody else.
Okay, and who took over on guitar?
Ray Molina.
And where was Ray from?
St. Paul.
Now, your second album is coming out here at the end of 1968. I'm going to ask you to just go through the song titles and tell us which songs are in the order and who was the writer of the songs.
Okay, and Zippy and Denny were still the vocalists and the guitar player of that album. It was Mindbreaker, and that was Kane and Waite. Denny Waite wrote that one. Tally Man, that was Jeff Beck's song. Here I Go Again was Area Parent.
Heir apparent.
Heir apparent.
That was an obscure band somewhere out of the UK.
Oh, were they?
Yes.
So you told me that.
I looked it up.
Morning Sun, that was Larry Loughborough. Under the Scream of Double Eagle. That was Zippy, Woody Woodrich, and Denny Waite. Apologies, 2069, Warren Kendrick. And that was the Moog synthesizer. And then Kaleidoscope by Procol Harum. Blues One, that was Zippy and Denny. And She's Not There, Were the Zombies.
All right, let's talk a little bit about Kaleidoscope. And I understand this was the song that Warren Kendrick came up with, the phase-shifting idea.
Mm-hmm. And I think we were the first to use that. Then Ichiku Park.
That's before Ichiku Park?
I believe so. Okay. And, but Warren came up with that effect. And that was my favorite song on that album. That was the one I liked the most. And that was more, we really get into the psychedelic. You know, the first album was more garage bandy kind of stuff. But we really started getting into the psychedelic on the second album.
Let's see if you recall this gig on January 11, 1969. The Litter played a show with Conqueror Worm at the Aragon Ballroom in Chicago. And at that same venue, later that month, the band opened up a show for The Birds and the Flock.
Yes, we played the Aragon a lot. There are other artists that I remember we played with. We played with Iggy Pop, Rotary Connection, and a lot of bands that were just about to, that were breaking at the time, and that was kind of our home in Chicago, other than the Kinetic Playground.
Were you going back and forth between Chicago and Minneapolis a lot for jobs?
Yeah.
But you had a place. Where was the place in Chicago where the Litter stayed?
We had a house, and it was I can't remember the street it was on, but it was on the north side of Chicago, and we actually moved to Chicago because our management was Scott Deneen. He was in Chicago, and so we were there for probably at least a year, you know, for sure at least a year, and all the bands that were starting to rise that Scott was involved with, the guys that wrote Green Tambourine, who were they, Lemon Pipers,
right?
They were over the house. Oh, we got to be really good friends with the Shadows of Night, so it was kind of our house was the house that a lot of the Chicago bands at the time that were starting to make it, a lot of fun, you know. And but that was where we took the cover, the back, or the front, the inside on the gate, on the gatefold.
You're talking about ABC Probe?
Yeah.
Let's see, that was early 69, started recording, okay.
Yeah, but that house was the picture. The picture was taken from our house.
Oh, the photo on the cover of the Probe album is the front of the Litter house?
Well, on the inside of it, of the gate.
In the inside of the gatefold. Yeah. Okay, so in early 1969, you started recording at GM Studios in Detroit, Michigan, for ABC Probe. What do you recall about recording at GM Studios in Detroit, Michigan?
It was on 9 Mile Road. I remember that. Nice studio. That was the first time that we really had a real producer producing us.
That Punch?
That was Punch.
And his real name is Edward Andres?
I believe so. We called him Punch. And he did a lot of Bob Seger stuff and a lot of the Detroit bands at the time. It was kind of cool. I didn't realize that it was Punch at the time, but years later I went, oh, that was our producer? He did Bob Seger and, you know, and a bunch of other bands.
Do you recall the engineer?
No.
Jim Bruzees?
No, I don't recall that.
All right. Let's run through the list of the songs on ABC Probe. Do the same thing as the last one.
At Journeys, that was Ray Molina and Mark Gallagher. Feelings, that was Mark Gallagher and myself and Jim Kane. Silly People was Ray Molina and Mark Gallagher. And Blue Ice was Jim Kane and me. And For What It's Worth was Buffalo Springfield. Little Red Book by Love. Breakfast at Garden Sons. Ray Molina wrote that one. And Future of the Past was Jim Kane, and that was my drum solo song.
Is there any story behind that song, Breakfast at Gardentons?
Personally, I didn't like it, you know, for a long time, because I thought it was going in a direction, because we brought in more hard rock, you know, with a lot of, you know, prettiness into it, but it was still hard rock. And that's what we were really into at that point. And I thought Breakfast at Gardensons was more of a M.O.R. song.
Was that about a real place in Chicago or not? Or don't you know?
I don't know. I don't know the story behind it. It says, here's a song. And they went, okay, I'll play drums. And I did my tracks.
So from that session, ABC Pro puts out a 45. And that is with Feeling, backed with Silly People. Did that have any success on the air?
Silly People had a bullet on it.
The B-side.
Yeah. And that was the one that they picked for the single, really. Mm-hmm. And it was getting a lot of airplay. It had a bullet in Billboard. That album did hit the Billboard charts. And then suddenly, in those days, if the words were taken wrong, they would pull the song off. And we were one of the bands that got nailed on that.
Because of Silly People?
Silly People, yeah.
What are the words that are offensive?
Well, it was the actual Silly People. We did a radio interview, and the DJ asked, why are you calling everyone Silly People? And we said, we're not calling everyone Silly People. We're just calling some people Silly People. And that was it. And they pulled that song, and it was, and again, it had a bullet on it. And so that kind of hurt.
Now, from what you told me before, I find this rather interesting. You had never, no one in the band had ever met the ABC Probe executives until they came out to watch the Litter play a job at the Grand Ballroom in Detroit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got signed. They never did. They never heard us. But, you know, Scott Dineen, however he did it, he got a two album deal contract with them.
Do you remember the night the executives came out to see the Litter play?
Yes, I do.
What happened?
They gave us $1,000. I remember that. They just handed us a check for $1,000 and said, welcome aboard. And they liked us.
Also playing that night was Three Dog Night. Was that do you recall that night as being hot?
It was like 140 degrees. Everyone was fainting. It was really kind of cool. If you had long hair in the area, it was called the Grandy Ballroom, right? I mean, the Grandy, okay. I believe. And it was kind of in the slums of Detroit. But if you had long hair, you were cool, if you were white. But if you had short hair and you weren't cool, then there was possible you'd be hurt, you know, if you know. That was one of the things that I really thought was kind of cool. That I felt I wasn't scared because I had long hair, you know.
Now, Billboard magazine reported on August 16, 1969, that the Litter album peaked on the Billboard 200, the album chart, at number 175, and was on the charts for 5 weeks. And this was the only Litter album to chart on Billboard in San Juan, Puerto Rico. The 45 and the album both hit number one. However, the band's manager was unable to book the band there to take advantage of the situation.
That wasn't correct.
That's not correct? Okay.
What I remember was management forgot to book the flight. We did have a date.
To play in Puerto Rico.
Yes. And they didn't book the flight. And the only thing that we could do was a charter, I mean, a flight, a private flight going down there. And they wanted like, you know, $20,000 for the flight. And I believe that we were contracted for $22,000 that we were going to make. And so it didn't happen.
Do you recall seeing the first billboard ad of the album promotion?
Yes.
What was the ad like?
It had a doctor holding a baby. This is the birth of a band, I think. Or it was...
Yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah, and it had a statement like, birth...
The birth of a band.
Yeah, and it was like, explosion. Birth and explosion like death or something like that, you know, and it was on it. And they took the full page ads on Rolling Stone, Cashbox, and Billboard. Rolling Stone, Billboard, and Cashbox.
Right.
Yeah. You know. And one had on it over 30,000 the first week. The one that I have on my wall that we found was nothing about how many it sold. So,
okay.